Welcome to another edition of Thinkative, the podcast for philosophers, seekers, and the generally curious. I'm Tim Newton.
I'm Matt Parker.
And here we are getting together to chat again on subjects philosophical, where we hope to shed some light on those questions about life and the universe and pretty much everything. And in the process, enjoy a bottle of wine. In the hope that at least we can get to the bottom.
at least that way we might get to the bottom of something.
That's right. Yeah, indeed. So wherever our conversation takes us. So today we are enjoying a yellowtail Shiraz, which of course is an Australian Shiraz, spicy, licorice, and the taste of sweet berries abound. On this little number, and
it's a good fallback, that one. You can always find
it is
the Yellowtail Shiraz.
Yeah, you could join us here by getting one of these bottles for $5.99, $6.99 at your local corner shop.
Absolutely,
that's what we've done, and we're settling down to enjoy a couple of glasses and talk this time
about
the question is
a big question.
It is a big question. And the question is, why is there something rather than nothing? I mean, where do you start with that one? We exist, we're in a world, we're in a universe, we look around, we see things, we touch things, we experience things. All this something surrounds us and we thrive or, suffer in it every day. And yet, why is it here? Why is there not just a big empty void where nothing ever happened and nothing ever will?
Yeah, we have these stories like the Big Bang about how the world came to be. So if we have a story about how the universe, I don't mean just this planet, but the universe came into existence, then it would seem that that stuff might not have happened and then there just wouldn't be anything.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's, I think, kind of modern science has given us a perspective that allows us to now imagine that, gosh, there just might not even have been any empty space, just nothing at all. Not even empty space. Is that conceivable?
What, absolute nothing of nothingness?
Nothingness, yeah, just really nothing.
I can't understand nothingness. It's like when I struggle with infinity, really.
You know, it's the opposite problem.
It's the opposite problem of nothingness. I find something I find easy to grasp. So if, a big empty space, a big black void, I can imagine that. But not even a big black void.
Yeah, not even black, no colors, no void, just a, I mean, why not? Why did there have to be all this stuff, or any stuff at all?
Yeah, why, Matt?
Well, I have my little pet ideas.
Oh, do you? Good.
Yeah, from when I was 12, I came up with a couple.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, tell us of your first theory of why there is something rather than nothing.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right. So, when I was about 12, I thought about this problem a lot, and I had the idea, and it's very similar to a modern idea that I later found out has been, discussed much in philosophy. But my idea as a child, as a tween, was, well, look, if there at first were nothing, or okay, that doesn't make sense because we're imagining nothing, so there's not even time. But if it were the case that there was nothing at all, then that would mean that anything is possible, right? Anything at all is possible because there are no constraints, there are no laws, there are no laws of physics.
Yeah.
Anything could happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So then there would be all these sort of possibilities, possible worlds, right? Lots of different kinds of worlds that could exist because anything is possible in this scenario I'm imagining, right? And then within these possible worlds, there would be, in some of them there would be people, in some of them there would be, winged tarantulas. And in some of them, there would be you and me.
Yeah.
And these beings inside these possible worlds don't know that they're merely possible. So,
right.
You know, they carry on their lives believing that they're real when in fact they're only mere possibilities in a vacuum, right?
Ah, okay.
And so then my idea, right, as a child was that, okay, so this is what's happening. This is just a possible world of many millions of possible worlds, and there isn't actually really any difference between what's possible and what's actual, what's real.
Right.
Right? So, and that's why there is something rather than nothing. It's because it's possible. And the difference between what's possible and what is actual is just an illusion. It's an arbitrary distinction that we've made up and that we don't even really understand.
Okay. So, I mean, we are just, you know, we're a probability. We're a, you know, we're a possibility here, sitting here discussing possibilities or the lack of. But doesn't that require an imagination? If things are going to evolve from nothing, how do they ferment? What creates these ideas of a winged tarantula and, you know, books that talk, you know?
Yeah, right. God forbid there would be many worlds that are actually just like Disney movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we could be, you know, there could be an infinite amount of Disney movies.
But
you know?
It would be even worse than Borges's Library of Babel, right? So do you know Borges, Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentinian author?
Yes.
From like early 20th century, right?
But,
yeah. So he has this famous story, parable. He wrote all these short form things. This is a little story about the Library of Babel. And the Library of Babel, that you have this sort of geometric structure of, I think they're hexagonal rooms that are all connected and they're all just full of books, right?
Mm.
And the books, according to some inhabitants of the library, because it's this massive structure, people don't know where it ends, and people just live in it and move around. And one of the theories is that every single possible combination of letters of a certain length, and it's something in the, you know, thousands on so many hundred pages, every single possible combination exists somewhere in the library.
Yeah.
And so you can go and look in the library and look at all the different books, and almost all of them are just complete gibberish. And then every once in a while you'll find one that has a spark of meaning to it.
Mm.
And in principle, you might find one that tells the whole story of your life in the library.
Yeah.
And in principle, you might find one that tells the story of your life, except that there's one part of it that's wrong.
All right.
And you know, sort of tribes evolve that travel through the library looking for their own stories and looking for truth and so on. So this sort of array of different possible worlds would be almost as horrible as that, because every possible world that's not a logical contradiction would exist in some sense. And some of them would be just like this, and some of them would be a little different, and most of them would just be just completely random, weird sorts of.
Yeah, no, and that's the, you know, that's the theory that I'm familiar with in terms of the quantum many worlds theory, which is what you're probably referring to. In
well, there's the quantum many worlds theory, but there's also a philosopher called David Lewis who we've gone completely a different direction than I was expecting. There's also a philosopher called David Lewis who has proposed a view called modal realism. And it's a particular kind of modal realism in which every possible world exists. And the meaning of the term actual, to say that this is not only possible, it actually happened, that's just an indexical term. It means that happened in my world. To say that it's possible means that it happened in some other world.
Right, okay.
So that's David Lewis. And he proposed that idea not as a theory of quantum physics or anything like that. He proposed it as the best way of understanding what we mean when we say things like "it's possible," "it has to happen."
Mm.
His interpretation of modal language is to propose a completely radical metaphysics in which everything that's possible actually occurs. And this is an idea in philosophy that's still much discussed and widely disparaged because it's absolutely loony, right?
Right. Okay. but I mean, also it shows that the thing about this is we can look at potential universes and beyond anything that is within the realms of our current imagination, and then we'll explode our minds into other ways of thinking about things. There are an infinite number of possibilities for our understanding or our expectation or our imaginings of something.
Yeah.
Here we go.
A vast infinity, not just a small infinity, a vast infinity.
A vast infinity, you know, an infinite number of infinities.
Yeah.
It is endless. But that's all predicated on the idea that there is something, that there is lots of something.
Oh, yeah.
And lots of different types of something. There is something. definitely. There is. I mean, there is no doubt that there is something. I mean, there's something here in front of me, and that's, you know, Jason.
Hmm.
Jason and you.
Are
you
sure of that?
I am sure of that. Well, this you know, reminds us of an earlier question as well, doesn't it? I'm pretty sure. I'm enjoying the fact that there's something here, or I see something. So why is there something?
Why is
there not nothing? Are we looking at the idea of this being created? Have I just created this? What are you doing? I mean, what are you seeing? You've got something going on over there, I'm sure.
Or am I just imagining? I've got a little bit of wine.
You've got some wine.
It does seem that there's something, and of course the oldest answer to that question, or at least the most time-honored answer to that question is, there must be a reason why there is something rather than nothing,
yeah.
And that reason is called God. Right, so that was Leibniz's argument, and he was the one who framed this question in why is there something rather than nothing? And Leibniz believed that there had to be a reason for everything, right? That was one of his firmest tenets, and it's called the principle of sufficient reason. Nothing happens without there being a sufficient reason for it to happen, something causing it to happen, something making it necessary to happen.
Does it have to exist for a reason, or there just needs to be a reason behind its existence?
That's a good question. I think for Leibniz, it's more the latter, right? There has to be a cause.
Right.
That's an interesting question. I don't know Leibniz well enough to know his views about sort of teleological causes, about purpose. But ultimately, he did believe that the universe was created for a purpose, and he believed it was the best of all possible worlds, and it was created by God. Because God was a nice guy, why would he create a world that's subpar, right?
So as far as Leibniz was concerned, this was the best of all possible worlds?
That's right, that's right.
Okay, my God, there must be some really, really messed up possibilities.
What exactly is the problem? Why couldn't you, Leibniz, have invented a world in which Tim remembered to get another bottle of wine?
Yeah, exactly.
God, not yeah. Leibniz. Not your fault, Leibniz.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a... It could be a little bit better in so many ways.
God's let you down, Dr. Matt Parker. But yeah, exactly. Why is so? I mean, you know, given that Leibniz was, you know, had his ideas about this being the best of all possible worlds, he did think then that there was a creator behind this. This is kind of quite meaty. This is that, you know, whether or not this existence that we appear to share.
And this is why he brings up the question, right? It's part of an argument for the existence of God, and it's an argument that goes back even to Aristotle, and I think it was Thomas Aquinas is famous for posing it as one of the five ways. So it's just one of many arguments that God must exist, and for Leibniz, it's based on this principle of sufficient reason. There has to be a reason for everything, for each thing, and so. That reason has to be something that doesn't require another reason. It has to be something that has its cause in itself. And that's a pretty cool thing, and it's very sort of mystical. So we call that thing that has... Sorry, I'm trivializing Leibniz. But we call that first thing that has its cause in itself God. And that's kind of nice because it ties in with another argument for the existence of God, right?
Okay.
There's also the ontological argument. So the ontological argument is... Well, look, we have this concept of God as something that's really, really great and has all perfections. And existing is a lot better than not existing. So part of our concept of God is that he has to exist, or else he wouldn't be the best sort of possible thing. Right? So we have this concept of the greatest ultimate possible being, and part of that concept is that it has to exist, and therefore God exists. So it's a proof that God exists because... If he didn't exist, it wouldn't be God. It wouldn't be the greatest thing.
Okay.
So that's the ontological argument for the existence of God. And it ties in nicely with the cosmological argument because now you understand why God has the cause for his existence within himself. It's part of the very concept of God that God has to exist. Otherwise, God wouldn't be the most perfect being or the most perfect possible being.
Because what is the motivation, though, for this beauty of existence. I mean,
Who says existence is so great after all?
Yeah, and what is that? What is the motivation? I mean, I still don't see why that would make God have to exist. Personally, you know, I don't believe in God. I look at, you know, when I think of the universe, I think of this as an explosion of, well, yeah, exactly why the universe exploded into being, and through fluke, a certain combination of chemicals happened, and through fluke, a couple of bacteria morphed into something that would create a genetic chain, and that chain split. Blah, 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 blah. So I see it very much as a kind of, over the billions of years, some sort of kind of chemical evolution that's evolved into a life force that needs to create itself. That's how I view, you know, our presence in the universe. It's quite empiricist, I suppose.
Well, empiricist, except for that little bit of life force bit, which sounds very sort of like vitalist, right? Very sort of like 19th century spiritual, quasi-spiritualism about the nature of life as opposed to...
A bit Star Wars-y. I suppose so. And what came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, do these chemical reactions create some sort of developing life force which then kind of evolves itself over time? And becomes an imperative, because life is great. You know, the existing is fantastic. You know, it's much better to exist and be aware and have some consciousness and go, wow, you know. I mean, it has its miseries as well, but it's a fabulous thing to be alive in general.
We all like it.
I mean, but that's why. I mean, but are people not projecting that idea onto this? You know, this perfectionism of God. They're going, well, you know, life at its best, at its purest, and our motivations at their most purest and our most loving and our most positive. Is that not what we think of as God? And do we not then love the idea of God and therefore say, well, God, you know, God must exist.
It's a pretty flimsy argument if you ask me, but I don't really buy any arguments for the existence of God. I think they all fall down, but so it's sort of like...
But is that not what makes the idea of God appealing is what I mean, you know?
What
the fact that by existing, we exist on Earth and we think, you know, in our best moments when we feel, you know, great love and positivity and we do fine things and we feel that we are acting with compassion or whatever, we go, that's the kind of what we would like to externalize as a kind of God, the idea of God.
So that's very interesting. So it's like the chain of reasoning goes, at certain points at least, I really enjoy existing, and so whoever gave me that must be really nice, and so God is great, right?
Not the fact that it was given to us, but the fact that that force that we feel when we feel our existence at its best and we act at our best, that is what we would imagine God to be.
Yeah.
And so we think that would be what God would be like if he did exist.
Yeah, we made him in our own image.
Yeah, we made him in our own image. Yeah. And therefore we think of this external being, this beneficent, you know, caring being. But of course, you know, we look at what we see and the suffering around the world and we just go, well, you know.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, thanks a million.
good job.
Yeah, good job. But I'm kind of digressing there, really, because I just think that we make God in our image rather than the other way around. But for a lot of people, they see the idea of God as an external force that has given us life and breathed into us that great purpose.
Yeah, and created the world that we live in.
And created the world we live in and everything around it. But I'm kind of digressing, really. But that's my kind of take on it.
Yeah. So I think the interesting question about this argument for the existence of God is, you know, well, okay. So one question is it a good argument for the existence of God? And one problem with it is, okay, so let's suppose we accept that everything has to have a cause, and let's suppose that we accept that the totality of things has to have a cause, which is another step that we could pick at. And so then there has to be something else that is the cause of everything, and maybe it has its cause in itself, and that's why it doesn't need a further cause.
Mm.
But then why on earth should that be anything like the being that we call God, right? The being that we imagine who's all-knowing and all-loving and all-powerful.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
That seems like quite a leap. Now, Leibniz did have an argument for that, which is basically that, well, you know, there are all these perfections in the world or all these good things in the world, like love and knowledge and power.
Mm.
And these things have to come from somewhere. They can't just be, you know, they can't just sort of emerge out of thin air. You know, just like we now have the law of conservation of energy and matter, he had sort of a law of conservation of good, right?
Oh, okay.
So the good can't just come from nowhere, so it must have come from God. And therefore, uh-huh. God is, you know, as good and powerful and benevolent as all things in the universe. So he's sort of maximally good and benevolent and knowing. So that's Leibniz's argument. It's because of the world he created that we know that the Creator is good and benevolent and knowledgeable.
Mm.
Right? But of course, then you have the problem of evil, which is, well, if God is so wonderful, why did he do this to me?
Yeah.
And so many other people, really. You don't have to be selfish to see absolutely. The problem. So there's that argument. And then there's, let's come back to this question, right? Okay, let's suppose that everything that happens in the world has to have a cause. And this is an issue that Bertrand Russell brought up in a famous debate years ago on the radio about the existence of God.
Mm.
Let's suppose that everything that happens in the world does have to have a cause. That doesn't mean that the totality of all things has to have a cause, right? So Russell's analogy was, every person has a mother. That doesn't mean that humanity has a mother.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a different thing.
Mm.
It's an altogether different thing. So this argument that just because everything has to have a cause, then the whole universe has to have a cause, breaks down unless you can find some reason why the universe itself has to have a cause, not just the things that are in it.
Mm.
See what I mean?
Mm.
So one possibility is that the universe has just always been here, and everything that happens in it has its cause, but there's no first cause because it's just always been here, and it goes on and on and on into history forever.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's the thing with current scientific theory. We go, well, no, it appears that
mm-hmm.
the universe did have a beginning. It will reach a certain point where it's kind of expanded beyond itself, and then it starts to implode go back to nothing.
Well, I think these days we're thinking that that's not going to happen. It seems to be expanding faster and faster.
Forever and ever.
Yeah.
Amen.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so they call it the heat death of the universe.
It's just going to fizzle out.
It's going to spread out so much.
Yeah.
No, all the atoms will just no longer be in contact with each other. Everything will just be cold. And
so we're quite lucky to be in the middle of in the good period. You know,
is it luck? Is it a coincidence?
I believe it is.
What other period could we exist in?
We could only exist in the period that we.
We exist in, exactly.
We can only exist in a period that is suitable for our existence.
Right? Yeah.
It's a Goldilocks period.
Yeah. We could only exist when we exist, absolutely. It's not... It's,
well, no, we could exist at different times, but we couldn't exist in a period of the universe that is so hot that particles can't even stick together.
Yeah.
So we can only exist in a period of the universe that's reasonably suitable for the existence of life. So it's not lucky, at least... That's called the anthropic principle. It's one way of explaining, why the conditions of the universe are so suitable to life. It's not design. Mm. It's a selection effect.
Mm.
If you wake up and look around you and you see a place where it's possible to live, well, don't be surprised, because if it weren't possible to live there, you wouldn't wake up. You wouldn't be there
in the beginning. No, exactly.
It's like the idea that if the universe was created, why didn't they just create it from the start to be right for life? Why didn't... why did they have to give it a few billion years?
Yeah, which is why creationists refuse to believe any of the stuff that don't fall in line with their ideals. Because they say, well, yeah, that can't be true. No. We are the planet is 6,000 years old, whereas we tend to come from a different perspective.
Yeah,
there's another argument then. Has life just happened to develop because of the conditions that the universe is in, as it appears to be, or have we been given some kind of, has someone breathed something into us? Is there a force that's brought us about? Is there? I mean, I think it's just a matter of the fact, the vastness of the universe. At some point, in some corner of the universe, the conditions are going to be right where life can evolve, and a certain amount of chemical interaction has brought about the beginnings of life, which has then developed into something much more interesting, where we can sit here and ponder on it.
Well, that's sort of an interesting inference then. So you're saying that because there is a portion of the world which is quite nicely tuned for the existence of life as we know it, then it would seem that there's probably a whole lot of other regions of the universe that are not like that, right?
Mm.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I mean, there must be other... I mean, it's likely that there are other bits of the universe out there, billions of miles away, where similar things are going on.
Yeah.
So far away.
So there are two sort of conflicting streams of thought here. One traditional line of thought is that the universe is the same everywhere, right? So the universe is homogeneous, the laws of nature that apply here are the same laws of nature that apply elsewhere.
Okay.
And even one might think that the sort of constants, the quantities that give weight to the numbers and the laws of the universe are the same here as they are somewhere else, right? Mm. That's why they're called constants. They're supposed to be the same everywhere.
Yeah.
But then there's another line of thinking that says, well, in some sense, there might be other regions of the universe where things behave a lot differently.
Right.
And maybe there are different sort of quantum worlds that behave differently, or maybe David Lewis is right and there are other sort of possible worlds that behave very, very differently.
Right, right.
But there are two opposing streams of thought there. One in which we assume that it's not necessarily a mere assumption, right? Henri Poincaré in the late 19th, early 20th century, probably early 20th, argued that, look, the laws of physics have to be the same everywhere, because otherwise they just wouldn't be laws, and we would find some way to explain why conditions are different here from there.
Mm.
And that explanation would be in terms of laws that apply everywhere.
Mm.
So there's the one view that that all of the universe has to be fundamentally the same. And then there's the other view that, well, the things that we consider fundamental in our region of the universe are actually just sort of local accidents that happen to be conducive to our own existence.
So what versions of these ideas about whether there's something, why there's something rather than nothing, which are the most appealing ideas to you then?
Well, so I'm very interested in the question of whether there could possibly be an answer to this question. And many people have argued that there can't possibly be any answer, or argued that we can't possibly know the answer, or argued that the question is somehow nonsensical to begin with. And while I don't have a strong inclination to think that any particular answer is the right one, I do think that it's a question that can be attacked and addressed and contemplated and worked on. And I think that one of the things that shows that is basically the same idea that I had as a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And the same idea that David Lewis had, that there might not be any difference between mere possibility and actual existence. We don't know how to explain what the difference is between what is possible and what's real, right? So,
right.
So for example, suppose that you are a dyed-in-the-wool empiricist. You only believe in what you can see and measure, right?
Yeah.
then suppose I say to you, well, okay, there might be another sort of realm of existence that is spatio-temporally disconnected from this one, in which there are, let's say, you know, unicorns walking around or what have you.
Yeah.
And we can't know anything about them, but they're there.
Yeah.
Now,
another dimension,
yeah,
if you like, yeah, that we can't make contact with.
So then it's very hard for an empiricist to even make sense of what that means, right?
Mm.
What would it mean for those creatures to exist, and what would it mean for them not to exist? That's something that we just don't, even for someone who's not a strict empiricist, we're not yet in a position to pin down the difference between something existing that we have no way of having evidence for and it simply not existing at all. So I think that there's a difficult problem of understanding what it means to exist and to be actual.
Mm.
And it might be the case that to exist and be actual is not any different from being merely possible. So what I take from that is not that that's the answer. Hey, yeah, so all possible worlds really exist. But just that there are ways of thinking about this problem that make it possible that there's an explanation for why we exist, and it might be just something of the form of actually existence and possibility are the same thing, so the reason why we exist is because we're possible. So I'm attracted by those kinds of ideas, and I realize that there are huge problems with them, the biggest problem being that there's just no way to establish something like that, or no obvious way. Who knows what sorts of arguments and even experiments someone might come up with. Look, there are different kinds of explanation, and maybe there's a kind of explanation that accounts for our existence.
Mm.
So one of the things that people do with this problem, they say, well, look, you can't explain why the universe is here, because the only real explanations are causal explanations. And funny enough, this is David Lewis's own view.
Right.
Right? So he never thought of his modal realism, this idea that all these possible worlds exist, he never thought of that as an explanation for why we exist, because he thought all explanation has to be causal. And you can't have a causal explanation for why the universe exists, because cause is a matter of physical laws, and physical laws only come into play given that a universe exists. Right?
So what about Lewis here then? I mean, how's he thought of?
Well, he was a brilliant philosopher, and he made a lot of very important contributions to a lot of areas.
Mm.
He is most known for this idea of modal realism, and pretty much everyone disparages it, and yet at the same time there are elements of it that seep through. So
I'm intrigued as to why that theory is more disparaged than others, really.
Well, because it seems
very bold. It's kind of an imaginative.
It's very bold and imaginative, yeah. And that's part of the problem. Like, philosophers don't want to be caught out proposing all sorts of crazy things about how the world is without any scientific evidence. Right.
But so, it's no more bonkers than heaven and or reincarnation or. To me, it seems to have as much validity.
Well, those ideas, though, have cultural establishment behind them.
Right.
And they probably wouldn't be taken seriously in academic philosophy at all if it weren't for the sort of cultural and traditional establishment institutions behind those ideas.
Right.
But they are studied carefully and taken somewhat seriously by some philosophers because they do have that sort of standing and basis in religion, because a lot of philosophers are religious people, and so they take these sort of traditional religious ideas seriously because they resonate with the philosopher's own the other philosopher's own traditional religious ideas.
Yeah,
but this possible worlds exist thing just sounds like cloud cuckoo land. And
Which is another possible world, yeah. Of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
So I'm a regular inhabitant.
Maybe we're in Cloud Cuckoo Land, and therefore it's correct.
I'm going to pour you some more wine.
Thank you very much.
There you go. I'm making up for the fact I didn't bring a bottle. Like
no.
That. Give it all.
I'm just giving you a hard time and using you for examples.
Yeah, bring
making
it on.
Make an example of you.
Bring it on. Mm. So yes, so they got you got David Lewis.
There's another, okay. So let me give you another one, right? So there's a current guy today who's a physicist. Oh, and now the name's escaping me, but he has this idea of the mathematical universe hypothesis.
Mathematical universe.
The mathematical universe hypothesis ties in with the sort of David Lewis possible worldview, but. More specifically, the mathematical universe hypothesis is the hypothesis that the world we live in actually consists of just mathematics, nothing else. And
that's not just numbers. That's just me kind of having a very primitive grasp of mathematics. So how do you mean?
It's abstract structure. Right? So
this world where we are now.
Yeah, this world where we are now just consists of abstract structures. So it's a kind of another way of saying that there is no difference between the actual world and a possible world that's structured in the same way.
Okay.
Right. So it's like, you could think that, okay, suppose that you're made of atoms and your atoms are made of subatomic particles that are made of quarks that are made of some kind of stuff. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now that stuff way down there towards the bottom.
Mm.
Could be a completely different sort of stuff that just behaves the same way, right?
Yeah.
And there could be another you that has the same structure, moves in the same way, has the same history, and so on, except that the underlying stuff is a different kind of stuff.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
And that wouldn't matter at all, would it?
No.
That person would be exactly like you in all the important ways.
Yeah.
So the idea of sort of structuralist view of the universe is that the only thing that really matters about the physical universe is the structure of it, right? And so this stuff here can't go through that because when I hit my hand with the table,
mm-hmm.
right, the structure of the table prevents the structure of my hand from going through it.
Yeah.
And we as beings in this structure, as part of this structure, perceive this as something very physical and palpable.
Yeah.
But of course, we're just structures within it as well.
Obeying the same laws.
Yeah. So what seems palpable to us is just another structure. And so the argument, Max Tegmark is the guy. So the sort of argument he makes...
Max Tegmark.
Is that a great name?
That's a good name. Yeah.
Needs to be the film.
Max Tegmark.
Yes. Sounds like a villain from the X-Men or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's his sort of day, that's like his daytime persona. And then, you know, at night he becomes some evil, I don't know, structuralist.
he changes his inner structure.
Yeah, perhaps.
By day, yeah.
So I was just thinking about that. I was thinking, so if, say, for example, we were all living in a computer simulation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
We'd all be a purely mathematical construct, and yet we'd have no knowledge of the fact that we were living in a simulation, and hitting the table would be not defined by the physical, there's a table, but just because there's a rule that says, you know, a piece of code that says hand can't go through the table.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite the idea, right? Now, some people might say that, well, look, if you were a simulation on a computer, you would still have a physical instantiation in the, you know, chips of the computer, but it would be of a very abstract kind that doesn't look anything like what you think you look like, right? But so the basic idea of the mathematical universe hypothesis is that really the underlying implementation doesn't exist. All there really is the structure itself. And so when mathematicians study mathematics, they imagine these abstract structures in Plato's heaven, so to speak, right? Mm. So Plato thought of mathematical forms like an equilateral triangle as something perfect that exists in a different realm,
yeah.
And that the triangles here on Earth are just sort of shadows of them, right?
So Plato was imagining more beautiful triangles than the triangles we get here on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I'm struggling to imagine triangles beyond.
Oh no, of course, because you try to draw a triangle on your pad right now.
Oh yes.
Yeah, it's going to be rubbish compared to the true beautiful triangles in Plato's heaven.
That's not bad though.
Yeah,
I wouldn't get into Plato's heaven with that triangle.
No,
no. It's not bad though, is it?
It's a fine it's a fine approximation.
What if
of a
I colour it in?
That doesn't help.
Wouldn't help.
No. Oh. It's just an approximation of this ideal form of a triangle, right? And this was Plato's thinking about politics and everything, right?
Yeah.
These ideal forms that we try to attain to, and at best we approach them.
Yeah.
And that's all we can do is move towards them, right?
That's right.
So, okay. But okay. Tegmark's idea is that actually this is Plato's heaven, and you are the perfect you, and you are the mathematical structure that you are, Jason. And, you know, there's nothing imperfect about you. You're not some shadow of a better human being. You are one of the mathematical structures in Plato's heaven, and that's all that you are.
Right. So we could be in Plato's heaven.
Yeah.
And we could be just like top notch.
Yeah.
Unbeatable.
Well, there's no better to Newton
than the one anywhere, sitting
than you. Whatever David Lewis might think. Yeah. So then how do you bring that back to why does the universe exist? Well, then I guess I connect it to the idea question of why does the universe exist with the thought that, well, okay, so mathematical objects exist necessarily, right? So the number two doesn't stop existing just because we stop thinking about it. It's just a number. It's just a conceptual structure.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really need an explanation for its existence. And likewise, if we're just mathematical structures, we're effectively the same thing as possibilities. We're just mere possibilities that, you know, we are possible structures, and being a possible structure is no different from being an actual structure. But, you know, again, I realize that a lot of this is crazy and speculative, and I don't want to go down on tape saying, I believe that this is why the universe exists.
No.
But what I do think is that many people who have argued that the question is nuts are mistaken, and their arguments are terrible. So, like, I've stated that quite strongly, but there's a very respected philosopher named Adolf Grunbaum at Pittsburgh, and he started this great philosophy of science department at the University of Pittsburgh. But he's written several papers arguing primarily, I think, against the argument, the cosmological argument for the existence of God. So he's saying that this argument that there has to be a reason for the universe to exist, and therefore God exists, is rubbish. And okay. I'll agree with him on that.
Yeah.
But he goes further.
Yeah.
And he tries to say that the whole question, why does something exist rather than nothing?
Yeah.
Is a nonsense question.
Why?
He says things like, we don't really have a good motivation for asking this question. And then he says things like, well, why questions are contrasting. When you say, why did you leave the toothpaste cap off the toothpaste?
Yeah.
You're thinking, why did you do that instead of putting it on?
Mm.
Right? And when you say, you know, why did I get cancer? You're asking, why did I get cancer instead of not getting cancer?
Mm.
As if not getting cancer were somehow intrinsically more likely or preferable.
Mm.
And so Grunbaum says, when we ask this question, why is there something rather than nothing? We're lacking a viable contrast for it, right? So the idea that there might be nothing is itself nonsensical. So we don't have a good contrast. We can't say that there should have been nothing at all instead of something, because really for there to be nothing at all, in some sense, isn't logical, isn't coherent, doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And then another argument is that there's no reason to think that it's more likely that nothing should exist. It's perfectly plausible for something to exist. Maybe it's much more natural and likely for
something to arise than
nothing at all. And in that case, you know, our question is sort of misplaced and poorly motivated, because it's like asking, you know, well, why did the sun rise? Well, it always rises. Of course it does, you know, or I can't think of a better example. Like, you know.
I find it a very intriguing question, though.
What, because why is there something rather than nothing?
Because you don't, you kind of accept the something around you. You don't question the fact that there's something around you. And when somebody says, why is there something around you instead of nothing?
Yeah.
I think it's very good. I think it kind of forces you to think about existence, you know, about the, you know, the reason. Not, there isn't a reason. I suppose another way of looking at it would be.
You could always ask, you know, the other way around. Is you could say, you know, if we lived it, if there was nothing, and you'd have to say, well, why is there nothing rather than something?
Yeah.
it's this thing that the fact that there is something needs an answer.
Yeah.
When.
Maybe yes, exactly. Because if there was nothing, there would be no question.
Yeah.
Yeah, there would be nobody asking it, but still, we could ask hypothetically, if there were nothing, why would that be the case? And I kind of take I take a different view of that. I have a view about that. And my feeling is that, look, just because it's more likely, even if it's more likely for there to be something rather than nothing,
yeah,
that doesn't mean we can't ask why.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, geez, it rains more days than not in England. We can still ask questions like, why did it rain today?
Yes, of course.
Not because it was particularly unlikely, but we still want an explanation.
And that comes to something, you know, that often crops up when we're having these conversations, or I think about, is that it's all about asking questions.
Yeah.
The philosophy in itself is about questioning.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that any sort of argument against asking a particular question is really pernicious and should be viewed very, very critically. And, you know, unfortunately, like, these days, we no longer can rely on the logical positivist view of the early 20th century, which argued that some questions really are nonsense because we have a clear explanation of what counts as meaningful and what counts as nonsense. I mean, that idea is disparaged now, so even Grunbaum can't say the question is nonsense because that whole attempt to argue that this is nonsense and this isn't has failed. And Grunbaum can't improve the program, so instead he has to say something else like, it's just an ill-motivated question, and it's a non-starter, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I agree with you. Like, it's all about asking questions. We should always ask questions. We do have to make serious choices about which questions to fund, which research programs to fund. But, I think I like a sort of dovetail approach. I think we should try to pursue all the questions, and some more than others, but we should try to pursue them all at the same time and not cut any of them off and call them nonsense. Just keep working on them. Who knows? Maybe we'll make some inroads.
Yeah, I think we will.
I hope so.
And I think we should probably drink to that. I've got a drop left. You've got a drop left.
Just barely.
Yeah. Thinkative. Ooh. I'd like to thank Jason Reed.
Thank you.
For engineering and chipping in brilliantly.
Thank you, Jason.
And I'd like to ask Dr. Matt Parker to play us out.